The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 27, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today on this pretty hot day. Almost feels like we're turning into a tropical jungle here now. I mean, it's so green. Usually by this time in July, things are getting a little brown, and everything's so lush and green. It's just incredible, this weather we've had. Well, the last time I spoke here, it was at first Sunday of June, 8 weeks ago now. Weeks have really shot by, it seems. But I spoke on objectless awareness. And there's quite a bit there, far more than I could certainly bring out in a single talk. So I think I want to maybe say a little bit more about that today, or maybe use an example of the way in which this understanding of objectless awareness, or really our perceptual experience, it has to do with virtually everything we experience. And yet we don't account for it in our minds in a way that we conceptualize our experience. We pretty much miss it altogether, even though it is our immediate direct experience, this objectless awareness. Objectless awareness, this is how the awakened see the enlightened. They understand this, they realize this. There's nothing mysterious about it. You have this experience too. Your actual immediate direct perceptual experience is what we're talking about. You're not deprived of this in any way whatsoever. But until we realize it, to actually understand what our immediate experience is, we just pretty much ignore it. And we do this because we're so occupied, well, with what we think, with how we rationalize the world, how we put it together in our minds. And we're so caught up with that, and then all the interactions of the various things that we encounter in our daily lives, that we really don't appreciate or even really realize what the immediate experience is. And I've referred to this many times in various ways, but I might talk about just seeing. I would italicize that if I were writing it. Just seeing, just hearing, just tasting. We see, we taste, we hear, we think, but it's always with additional things. It isn't just the experience, even the thought. It's the thought within the thought, and the thought within the seeing, or the tasting, or the hearing, or the touching, or the emoting, what we're feeling. It's all mixed with our thinking, our grasping, our conceptualizing the experience that is taking place now. Or we could say even then, or will, but of course it's all right now. Whether this thought we're dwelling on at the moment is a memory, or if it's anticipation of something maybe we're looking forward to or dreading. But we're with that all the time instead of just here, present, with what is taking place. So this is this awareness we're speaking of, and this is the awareness I would say that the Buddha spoke of when someone asked him to sum up his teaching in a single word, awareness, he said. It's just this immediate awareness, objectless awareness. The awakened, that I speak of, the Buddhas, Buddha's an awakened human being. But again, I was saying that their experience isn't any different than yours. They have immediate, direct perceptual experience, as we do as well. But they might be, well, they not wouldn't might be if they're awake in this moment, they realize what the immediate experience is. And they're not fooled or taken by the otherwise sensate experience. We talk about sentient beings. When we leave here today at the end of the talk, we'll say, you know, sentient beings are numberless. And we're speaking of the vow. That's the bodhisattva vow, to save all sentient beings. Sentient beings are numberless. But this is a vow to save all sentient beings. Well, save all sentient beings from what? And what exactly are sentient beings? Of course, that's any being, any creature, any plant, anything at all that has some kind of sensate, take on the world, their experience through the senses. And we could say, well, these are sentient beings. We tend to think that something like maybe a rock doesn't seem to be a sentient being. I'm talking about in our everyday thinking. But even little creatures, you know, bugs and plants and certainly animals, we can sense that they have senses and are reacting to the world. But in Buddhism, and we could say that these are sentient beings, and in our everyday talk, I don't know how often we talk this way, or refer to such things as, this would be sentient beings. But in Buddhism, it's getting a little bit more specific than that. A sentient being, generally, then this would be a human being now, who is living through the sensual, experience, through our senses. But this difference from the awakened, in the sense that, they're taken in by the senses, we could say. And so the vow of the bodhisattva, one who wants to assist and help us to wake up, their vow, the first vow, we have the four vows that we say at the end of the talk here, but that first vow is to save all sentient beings, though they are numberless. So it isn't maybe just human beings. Numberless. But to save all sentient beings. So sentient being now, at this point, is really pointing to those beings, those... What are beings? That's another thing we could spend a couple of lectures on. But it's referring to those who are kind of taken in by the senses in a way that the awakened are not. And, well, how is it that we would be taken in by the senses? It is that we think, without even questioning this, that there are things out there that we're taking in through the senses, hearing, seeing, tasting, in any way, at all. Even thinking, we would add that in Buddhist thought, Buddhist way of looking at all of this. But the assumption, and it's usually a very quiet, hidden assumption, it's not really hidden, but I mean, if you just look for it, there it is, that there are things out there. And that's what we're taking in through our senses. And so this is what I talked about before, in my last talk here a few weeks ago. We would say that, this is what we take in through the senses, but it always holds objects. There are objects out there. And in fact, this assumption is so deep within us that the idea of objectless awareness the Buddha spoke of, what is that? How could we have objectless awareness? What would you be aware of if there's no object? That's a good question. So when the Buddha was speaking of awareness, if he's really referring to Well, I would capitalize this awareness, because it's not like our awareness of, say, I'm aware that I'm in a room, I'm aware that I'm talking to people. That's just kind of our ordinary awareness. What the Buddha is speaking of, and I wouldn't capitalize that awareness, but what the Buddha is speaking of when he says awareness, I would capitalize that. Because it isn't our ordinary awareness. Our ordinary awareness is of things, of objects. Whether it's even a thought or a feeling of some sort, whether we've named the feeling or not, you know, in our mind, or certainly physical objects out there, material objects of various kinds, and the comings and goings of all of these things. Yeah, that would be our ordinary awareness. But objectless awareness is the awareness that we don't really find things. And this is the actual perceptual experience. It is not something foreign to you. Again, the interaction that we have with this, I've used the analogy many times of tasting orange juice. The perceptual experience is, yeah, now you know. That's what knowledge now ties in with this too. True knowledge is, you know that, the taste of orange juice. You can't describe it to anybody. Well, sure, you can start describing things, but not in such a way that if they've never tasted orange juice, they can taste orange juice from your description. That's all conceptual. That's all grasping at objects, thinking that there actually are objects that we can refer to and manipulate and try to control and all that. Of course, we see ourselves this way as something. And others, they're things too. And we can abuse that understanding or, you know, in all sorts of ways, or we can do some good with it as well. It isn't like this is necessarily a bad thing, that we conceptualize the experience. It's very functional, useful for us. But it does not shed light on, so to speak, on what's actually taking place. And the awakened ones, don't go looking for them. You'll never really find an awake. But there are awakened people, yeah. Yeah. You'll never pin them down. Well, there's deluded people, too. You won't pin them down either. If you're awake to what's going on, you will realize that. There's no object. So you can't pin that deluded person down, or I'm deluded. Yeah. But when we think we can, no, that's what delusion is. And there are people who wake up to this and aren't confused by this. And we call them awakened. But it's never any particular person, because we don't actually find things. With the actual immediate direct perceptual experience, which is just objectless awareness, yeah, we don't actually find things. But there is, as I just mentioned with the orange juice example, this is actually pointing toward true knowledge. We think knowledge comes with the stuff I can grasp, the ideas and things I can control and, you know, learn things about in their relationships with other things. You know, yeah. And again, that's all functional, useful stuff. But none of that is really getting us in touch with reality, truth, what's really taking place. And it's because we're confused in this way. This is why the Bodhisattva vows to save these beings who are confused, and sentient beings who are confused in this way. And why would they need saving? Because this is where dukkha, our suffering, our confusion, is in this very confusion about this. And it shows up in all kinds of ways. I'm going to see if this won't be easy for me, but I'm going to see if I can give an example of how, in being confused in this way, we can exacerbate and perpetuate the confusion and the pain and the suffering that goes with it. Yeah, and maybe the joy, you know, of certain other kinds of events or whatever. Yeah, maybe, except it's all this stuff in the conceptual is temporary. It belongs to time, at least it seems to. It seems to be involved with time. And then there's the coming and the going of things. Yeah, and we understand that too. Yeah, and things are born, they die, their things are made or created, a new idea comes to mind. You know, things come seem to come into existence. We'll use that word existence, which is a very confused word. We might be confused about it when we try to think, what exactly do I mean by that? And you'll probably encounter confusion in your mind about that word. And there's a reason for that. I can just tell you, because we actually don't find existence. But then what's all this? Yeah, well, this is coming and going. Yeah, but we think things come, and then they persist for a time, then they go. And if it's a person, somebody we love, we're very concerned about that. We're happy when they're born, maybe while they're alive. People we grow to love and get attached to. Yeah, I mean, but we're all subject then to death, and we will die, because this is a characteristic of the things that we really deeply, unquestioningly believe are there, out there, and I'm taking them in through my senses, including me and aspects of me. You know, not just physically, I can think of my hand here or something like this, but also my mind, my emotions. Yeah, and all this is very real for us in a kind of a substantial way, where we think there's real substance, there's real thingness, there's about all of this stuff. Were we to be saved from this kind of confusion, and it is confusion. It isn't that this stuff is nothing. People confused what the awakened point to as nothingness. Nagarjuna's word, shunyata. Sometimes it gets translated as nothingness. That's absolutely not what he's talking about. We translate that word now most frequently as emptiness. But then that also sounds kind of hollow and empty. But it's really just referring to the shunyata is the word in Sanskrit, but it's just kind of pointing to the lack of substantiality in the thingness of the world and of experience, direct experience. We don't realize that this is why it's alive. It's dynamic. It appears to change. It appears to be full of things that come and go. But we see things as persisting. You know, and so we talk like this. This is what I wanted to point out this morning, that I think might be difficult for me to get across. But we'll use language like this. We tend to think of, well, we think of life, and that's a positive thing, a good thing. And then we probably in our minds, you know, at some point, we contrast that with death. Death, oh, unless it's something we don't want, or like, even to the point where it might be other people or something like that. Yeah, when they die, then we feel better. Or something. You know, some people have feelings like that. But death would be the bad thing. Of course, when it's loved ones who die, that feels very bad. But it's because we think that there are things, and that we don't realize there's just this appearance of coming and going, and that's. That's actually what life is. That's life. We don't see that. We see something, forms, whether it's a thought or a person or any number of things, but it forms and then it's persisting for a time, and we believe it or we don't like it, want to throw it away, any number, all the different ways we might be reacting to this. The world situation now, all of this. We carry on as if this were really a thing, that there are things. This is what the Bodhisattva says, all sentient beings are numberless. But they're sentient, meaning that they take all of what they take into the senses, they think are real. These things that are appearing. This is a confusion. The awakened don't see it that way. And it is a matter of just seeing, not thinking about it, not getting ideas, grasp views about it. There's where the pain, the suffering, and the confusion is, the dukkha. And the things that drive us to act in ways that sooner or later might be harmful or difficult for not only ourselves, but others as well. This is the human world, the muddy water. And we're so easily caught up in all of this. Were we to just see, wake up to the direct perceptual experience, not our conceptual experience, what we've conceived, what we've conceptualized, intellectualized. Were we to just wake up to what the immediate direct perceptual experience is, we would be saved from this confusion. That's why we have teachings like Dogen, where he says, you know, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. You know, the pursuing of words, you know, pursuing words and following after speech. Turn your light inward to illuminate immediate self right here, just this. It's not here, it's not, but it's just, you know, and it isn't me, it isn't you. But just this, which is always just this. It isn't changing, it's always thus. Everything within it appears to be changing, except that's only if we're thinking in terms of something persisting. So we speak of it as life and death. Life, that's good. And death, I don't like that, unless it's something I really want to get rid of anyway. Glad it's gone. But there we are, tossed about by all of this. But in Buddhist teaching, this used to really confuse me when I was an early student of Buddhism studying it. And the expression was always, or it seemed to be preferred over life and death, as birth and death. Birth, death. Yeah, well, okay, because I can understand, yeah, birth, okay. Things, you know, it applies not just to creatures being born, you know, animals and people like us, we were born. Yeah, and then, but then we live, and then we die. It's like the life is the thing that we contrast with death. But here in Buddhism, but I just kind of learned to tolerate, okay, so it's birth, death, but I would usually just change it to life, death, in contrast. And oftentimes when I'm just talking with people, not taking the time to do what I'm trying to do now, to point some of this out to you. And this was after I finally realized this too, which took some time. But it's just birth, death. Birth is what contrasts with death, not life. This is all life, the whole thing, including birth, death. This is all life. To the bodhisattva, everything is alive. Everything is alive. And so you mean like stones are alive? And don't go grab. No, you're grasping. It's just that this whole thing, is it really full of these distinguishable things? Not just the physical, the material things, but also just the emotional, the thoughts, the theories, the beliefs that we might hold. If you look at any one of these things, physical or otherwise, mental, it's all changing. It's constant. It appears, if you think there's a thing persisting, but notice there isn't anything that's persisting at all. You can't find that. In order to find something like that, you'd have to particularize it in your mind, make it a thing, and, you know, get a conceptual handle on that thing. Okay, now maybe apply a word to it or something. And you insist that it's still going on. Yeah. But now there's a lot of confusion in your mind and a lot of questions that come along with that. Of course, the big thing that we do is that, well, there's me. Well, there's certainly my loved one. There's people out there, and we're persisting, then we die. And, of course, then there's me. Yeah, I was born, of course, I don't really remember that, but I was told I was. I was given a birth date, okay. So on that kind of makes sense, because I really don't remember firsthand anything before that, in a sense. And it took a little while after that before I started. Yeah, okay, so it seems like, yeah, I was probably born about then, but here I got it right down to the minute, actually, on my birth certificate. But of course, what does that really mean? But we seem like we have this thing, birth-death. But what we're so concerned with is the stuff between there, the life that we say. And we contrast that, and we like that. Most of us, I want to be alive. Of course, there's some of us who get to a point where, you know, we might want to end this, you know. But we contrast this, the life with death. And then we think death will totally contrast the life. That's all, now that, and now it's death and death. Well, we have all kinds of thoughts there now too. Well, do I persist after death? And we come up with all kinds of stories. You know, the pearly gates and floating around on a cloud. And we have, those are kind of simple stories now that probably not too many of us hold. But there's all other, well, so many other ways to visualize that. And of course, there might be hellish places you go to, but it's still just grasping, holding on to at least one thing, which of course would be for each of us, would be me. Where do I go? Now, what about my loved ones too? I mean, do some of them end up in this place of torment? So all kinds of questions there. And you won't satisfy any of your pursuits in trying to answer questions with that. The Dalai Lama put it very well. It was just be kind to people and to things. You know, just act out of something like that. And don't spend too much time thinking about all this other stuff that it's really, it's kind of hanging on to a vision that we might have perhaps as children, where we, Santa Claus, you know, and he lives at the North Pole, and we're not even really too clear about where that is and what that is. And, but it sort of works up until we gain a little bit more knowledge. Finally, we realize that's not a very satisfying answer. But I can guarantee you, whatever answers you're holding to now, and even if you go into your nuclear physics and all that, I've used examples from science and all of this. There's a reason why I pursue that, but I'm kind of giving up on it now. But no matter where it is, whether it's through philosophy or religion or science or any, you know, just your work, you know, your politics, you know, and wherever you go with this. I'm not saying don't bother with anything. There's many things here to pursue, but there is human suffering. And maybe you can put that in the picture too. Maybe act in a way that doesn't exacerbate that or bring more of that into the world. It's already plenty here. Last night we saw a wonderful movie here, was shown here at Dharma Field. What was the title? One Life, I think. Was that the title? One Life. Anthony Hopkins starred in it, but as the old, what was his name now? Nicholas?
Nicholas Winton.
Nicholas Winton, yeah. The character. Hopkins played as an old man. Then there was another actor, I don't know, a younger man, playing Nicholas Winton, yeah, as a young man, saved many, many people as the Nazis were about to, right before the war there broke out there in Poland in 1939, and he managed to save quite a few children, 669, and deeply regretted that he couldn't save more. Anyway, but we can act in various ways in the world. And that's a pretty dramatic one. But we're acting out of kindness, as the Dalai Lama speaks of. Maybe forgetting ourselves. This Winton guy, people were amazed by that too. There was nothing in it for him, and yet he went way out of his way and did this remarkable, altruistic thing. And there's a lot there. It brought tears to my eyes, some of the scenes in there. and but a wonderful thing. But so there's plenty of us. I mean, not quite so dramatic as all that, but there's plenty of things for us to do. So this isn't about, you know, just stop and do nothing, because there is suffering in the human world. But so much of it, including the Nazis, but and so much of it, what's going on today, but just in our everyday life, our encounters with individuals, they're just with plants and animals. There's so much pain, suffering, and confusion, and maybe we're not really dealing with it in a way that maybe can lessen that to some degree. Don't make the mistake of thinking we can cure this. I don't know that it is curable. Maybe, I don't know. But you can waste your whole life away on something like that too. But we can turn our attention in this way and live in this way. And forget about yourself. The happiness, we think that, I'm occupied with I want to be happy, I want to be protected, so we're kind of occupied with this thing right here that we think we are. But if you don't spend too much time thinking about that, and just move in the world. And then there could be something like this that this young man, Nicholas Winton, saw, and he realized he could do something about this situation, and he did. And years later, he lived to be 106. He died, I can't remember when he died, but not that long ago. But it was amazing what he did. But even to a lesser degree, just in our interactions with plants and animals and the environment around us and all of that, we can live in a way where we can be more open to what's there in the pure perception, the pure objectless awareness. And don't think about the individual things. And that's another thing with Winton I was noticing in the film, and I imagine this was taken from the guy's real life. He wasn't occupied with kind of details. He had to fuss with them at times because he's dealing with bureaucrats and stuff. But it was just a direct situation that these children were in, and what can you do? And just acting out of that and not necessarily going by the theories and the laws and the various things that you have to follow or whatever. So just live directly with the world. But this is it's in this vein, maybe, that this is to live out of awakening, live out of enlightenment. That's the other thing in the vows that we have. There's the four bodhisattva vows that you recite when we end today. But there's also the pure precepts. I vow to live in enlightenment. Well, what exactly is that? I don't have any ideas about that exactly. But it is to live out of awareness. And also be aware of the pain and confusion that's in the world. Maybe we can act in a way to save all beings from this kind of confusion. That's the bodhisattva's vow anyway. Maybe that's too much for us. But live in a way to not increase their confusion or their anger or their whatever it might be. To ease that a bit. The other thing too is that to the extent that we can start to live like that in our own minds, we are, in spite of ourselves, we're really opening up to seeing more and more. Because what awakening is ultimately is seeing delusion. And to the extent that we can begin to see this more and more, as I just spoke of it, which may not be the best word, but we can find awakening through that. I guess I've gone on long enough. Maybe I better stop. But do you have any questions? Yeah.
You said your mom just kind of said,
well, I said the Dalai Lama.
Oh, at least your mom.
Well, she would. My mother had that kind of an attitude too.
Okay. Yeah, I was in the same.
She was always kind to people. Yeah.
That's great.
So I had a good model to look at, I guess.
That's awesome. My question is, what would be your one super crisp, clear definition of what being kind is?
Well, it is the inversion of the golden rule. Is it the inversion? It's the something or other. It's been a long time since I've looked at this. But and this is kind of the golden rule in Buddhist thinking. Yeah, we think of the golden rule as, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Yeah, I guess that's all it is, yeah. Which sounds good. It's just that if I'm the kind of person who likes to getting into fist fights, you know, I'd like to, you know, get into some fight with some guy here, and maybe that's not the best rule to live by, you know. So the golden rule actually falls apart. It sounds good, but the way it's stated in Buddhist thinking is, do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you. So it isn't prescriptive. It isn't telling us what to do. The Buddhas, they don't tell us what to do. They don't tell us what to think. They don't tell us what to believe. It's nothing like this at all. That's our problem, Upaya. You know, you're hanging on to that. You think that. There's going to be problems with that. Nagarjuna is the master at showing us this. So it's not prescriptive. But what I can point out is that, you know, if you do that, look at the pain, look at the entanglements, the suffering, the confusion that comes with the hatred that'll come from that kind of action. And not everybody wants that, you know. So it's more a matter of, you know, it's a matter of avoiding things. In Buddhism, we don't so much give directives. There's a little bit like in coming into a meditation hall, this isn't just for you, this is for everyone, you know. So don't keep adjusting everything for yourself. Just realize you're composing the room as well as just your posture and how you're going to sit and all of this and where you'll sit and things of this sort. So it's just kind of having your mind going out toward the whole and away from yourself. And this would be acting out of kindness in a very general sort of way, but not prescriptive. Well, so you should do this kind of act. Well, to that person, that might not be a kind thing to do, you know. Because you don't know their mind, you don't know their culture, perhaps their language, maybe if it's a foreign person or something, and or you're in a different land. I remember when I was in Japan, there were all sorts of things. It's like, really, they like this, or this is how I should act, or in China when I was studying Chinese, I remember I was told that in China, you know, people might come up to you and they say, well, I'd like your watch or something like that, and then he said, how much did you pay for that, they'll say, you know, they might have directly, how much money do you earn, you know, stuff like that. So we were kind of prepared to, you know, most of the people I was studying with were going overseas into China for a job, and that's what I wanted to learn how to read Buddhist scripture in Chinese, so that was my intent there. But anyway, but it's generally something like that, where you want to just open up and act out of the whole, and not out of your own personal.
And I would suppose for people that are inclined to look at life in this way as a collective, the driver is probably just realizing, if I'm trying to operate out of the whole, it just makes things a little cleaner. It's not so messy. Mm-hmm. And I guess humans and life in general, we're kind of driven to find the cleaner, less messy thing.
Well, maybe, yeah.
But that's the part that's weird, right? Because I know some people who are not driven to find the cleaner.
Exactly.
Yeah. And right. Then you're kind of going, now why would you do that? Because it seems like that's painful and unhelpful.
Yeah.
And yet you're doing it. And when I do it, I'm like, why did I do that? That's painful and unhelpful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's very strange.
Yeah. Well, for some of us, the confusion is quite deep. And as Dogen says, there's delusion within delusion, you know. So, we're complicated beings, as humans. But our complication is basically because we think so much. This is something Katagiri would say, you know. It's in our thinking. And to live out of as an awakened one as opposed to as a sentient being, where we're just totally caught up in what we're making of our sensual experience, where we can kind of just forget all that and just live out of the direct experience itself without thinking about it too much. But keep your mind on wholeness. And to the extent that we do, you're thinking less about yourself. And at some point, you might notice, you know, you're actually happier if you don't think about yourself so much. And you're less confused and all that, yeah. So these are very general terms I'm speaking in now here.
That works. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Anything else? Yes.
What's the difference between persistent and consistent?
And consistent?
Consistent. Persistent.
And
consistent.
And consistent?
Yeah.
Ah. Well, I don't know, is that, are you referring to some words that I used in my talk?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure if I made that contrast,
yeah.
but I could give that to you. In
okay.
my But persistent is the sense that we have something, well, that exists. Or maybe that was, I was contrasting persistence with existence. I was not contrasting, I was pointing out these are really the same thing. We think that things persist, and that means we think that things exist. Because if you really look very carefully at what it is that you have in your mind when you think something exists, if you look carefully, I think you can find that the assumption is that you think this thing, whatever it is, it could be a headache, it could be anything, a physical object or something. But what's in your mind there is the assumption that there's this thing here that's persisting. It's lasting. And it can't change. You may think, well, yeah, but it changes. Yeah, but that doesn't make sense. That's a contradiction now. If something changes, it starts to become something other than what it is. It's no longer itself as such. Though we think things are like that. That's what we think I am for most of us. Well, yeah, I was a baby when I was born as a baby. I was a little boy for a time. And now I'm an old man, see? So, and all along the way there was me, but changing all along. We think that. So we think there's something persisting there. We think that there's something existing there. But actually, you'll never pin that down. What? And life, as I was saying, life is this dynamic that, you know, if anything were like that, it would be dead. But it would not only be dead, this would be wink-out time. There wouldn't be any consciousness. That's another thing I could have brought into this talk when talking about this general subject. But the whole thing about mind and consciousness and, you know, what's going on there. We think, most people probably think now that we're kind of machines, you know, and we can build machines, a computer. We'll probably build a computer that's, and we'll say was sentient or something, meaning that it knows what it's experiencing. Something like that. Yeah, probably most people think that, but the knowing part is in the perceptual, not in the conceptual. If we think as conceptual beings, you know, or sentient beings, then we can have thoughts kind of like this. But if we're seeing this as an awakened one, we realize that mind or consciousness is reality itself. And it's not constructed out of the, certainly not out of the physical, the gross physical stuff that we find here in the world. We have that backwards. That is of mind. But I was thinking of the flag and the breeze. That's Huineng. But anyway, but there, we have a lot of different things that point to this, that mind is moving. It isn't a flag that's moving or the breeze is blowing, but it's mind. For the awakened, this is reality. That's the perceptual, what you could say, experience, but it's just pure perceptual, pure awareness, or objectless awareness. That's the real. It's not a thing. It's not, you know, in saying or using a word like that, it becomes an object. Yeah. But I hope you don't try to form that into something. What are we talking about? Just this. What is this? Well, this is not nothing. It's clearly not nothing, you know, because then we want to know, well, it's okay, so then what is it? And the awakened never say. Want to know what Nagarjuna is getting at in his teaching? He never says. He keeps pointing out that if you think that or you think this, he shows you, no, that's contradictory. That can't hold up. So what's the, we want him then to give us something. And we want to reach for something, take hold of something. But if you do that, that's part of the confusion that we suffer from. You're still looking for something to grasp, to believe in. Well, if I believe in the holy other out there, then I'll be saying, yeah, that might make you feel comfortable for a time. But it's kind of like believing in Santa Claus. At some point, when you start learning too much, you start to realize, well, this story isn't holding up very well. But if you put everything into that, well, then, of course, the other thing is to stop learning and try to shut down anything that might be supplying you with information. I don't want to hear about that. We see that going on in our culture today now, too. So, yeah. But you want me to contrast, you know, I forgot your two words now.
Consistent.
And consistent is just simply, you know, in a logical sense, you just remain consistent with, you know, if you do want to put something down there, and that's what logic serves us with, is that, okay, now you can say these other things and keep it consistent with this point here. But that only goes so far. It helps to, you know, settle things down, but all of that is taking place within the conceptual realm. And what the awakened are helping us with is that the conceptual realm isn't the whole thing. There's something else here that you're not paying attention to. And I talked about this in a talk I gave last fall. Oh, I forget the title of it now. But I talked about the two boxes, where I kind of talk about the point I was trying to make just now. Yeah, but I don't know, did I help you with that at all? Yeah, okay, thank you. Do we have? Okay, I guess we have a little. If there's any other question, anybody on Zoom? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.